So, malnutrition, you've got it in your handout. It's an exciting area. It's a lot of metabolic support. You can use TPN, you can use enterols, you can use shakes, of course, avoiding sugar. The next one is immune augmentation, talking about the immune system. The immune system can be enhanced by many vitamins, and this is clearly in the literature. Minerals, quasi-vitamins, amino acids, herbals, foods, many foods can help, positive emotions like love. And then the immune system can be reduced by toxic metals, cadmium, lead, mercury, volatile organic chemicals, sugar, omega-6 to omega-3 to 6 ratio, and stress or depression. Let me stop here. We had a patient who came to us with advanced breast cancer. She had stage 4. She had been to her Colorado hospital nearby, went through chemo, radiation, surgery, bone marrow, failed therapy, went to Mexico, failed therapy, came to us in a wheelchair, slumped up with so much bony metastasis that she was on opiates, morphine, and she was darn near comatose. So she got with our program. Full court press, did everything we could. Within 2 months, she wasn't dead. She was off pain medication. Within 6 months, there was a dramatic shrinkage of her tumors based upon CAT scans. Within 14 months, she had an excellent quality of life. She was playing with her kids, her hair had grown back, and there was very little measurable tumor left in her body. At that point, her husband, who was your basic John Wayne steak and potatoes Colorado farmer, and thought she had beat the cancer and was tired of all this strange food and her going to the doctor, said, I'm out of here. And a month later, she died of cardiac arrest, maybe a broken heart, who knows. So, point is, stress or depression plays a role here. The immune system, we need to pay more homage to it. Number 3, protection from the toxic side effects of medical therapy. We know that antioxidants, this is cancer cells, are primarily an anaerobic, glycolytic, acidotic organism, meaning they thrive in an oxygen-deficient environment. They are using sugar to an excess, 3- to 4-fold increase in glycolysis. They are an obligate glucose metabolizer, and because of that, they give off lactic acid, an abundance of acids, as opposed to the normal cell. So what happens is we load the patient with antioxidants, and what we find is that the cancer cell does not absorb antioxidants as efficiently because it's an anaerobic organism. What's an anaerobic organism going to do with an antioxidant? It's like giving a gopher sunglasses. It doesn't need them, except vitamin C. And studies have shown that cancer cells absorb an extraordinary amount of vitamin C. And this was a study done at Sloan Kettering where they said, based upon this, we say that you should never give a patient going through chemo or radiation any vitamin C because we know that the cancer absorbed a disproportionate amount of ascorbic acid because we know that cancer is an obligate glucose metabolizer and ascorbate and glucose are nearly identical in structure and that what's happening is a cancer cell thinks it's pulling in its favorite fuel, glucose, when it's pulling in this ascorbic acid. And so their conclusion was don't use ascorbic acid, when in fact, ascorbic acid by itself, one antioxidant in an anaerobic environment will become a prooxidant quickly. Because what is an antioxidant? It's an electron donor. I'm an antioxidant. I gave up one of my electrons. What do I now become? An electron thief. I got an empty hand. I become a prooxidant unless you become lipoic acid. And so you gave me an electron. Now I'm not a free radical. So one antioxidant, Victor Herbert was right in a sense. One antioxidant by itself in an anaerobic environment quickly becomes a prooxidant. That's a good thing. You force the cancer to swallow a hand grenade and then it blows up. So we gave it a bunch of antioxidants. And then we came in with chemo and radiation, and we found that the prooxidants were more likely to kill the cancer and not the healthy cells. And what we find is that the literature review clearly supports this. There's several reviews that have got hundreds of studies in them, and as I mentioned, antioxidants will protect an aerobic cell but not an anaerobic cell. So for instance, here's a recent study. came out in the Journal of Clinical Oncology in which they gave patients who were going to get cisplatinum with either a placebo or vitamin E. And what they found is on these 27 patients, those who got the placebo, 86% of them experienced neurotoxicity, neuropathies, tingling numbness in the extremities. Those who got vitamin E, only 31% experienced neuropathies. Clear statistical significance that vitamin E protected against the damage from cisplatinum without protecting against its anti-neoplastic activity. It kept killing cancer. So we're on number four, selectively starve the tumor. One of the studies that supports this is from animal models. Of course, it's interesting that you look at these drug companies. They get all excited about, here's the new drug we've come out with for cancer. It worked great in animals. We bring it to humans and it's not working so great. Why? Because in animals you can control their diet. In humans, they're living on Pop-Tarts and Pepsi, and what you've got is all these wild prostanoids and eicosanoids and omega-3 and omega-6 imbalances. If you can control the diet, some drugs work better. But in this animal study, what they did is they took mice, put them on three different diets to alter their blood glucose, then injected them with an aggressive breast cancer. And what they found out is that if they gave them a diet that simulated, let's say, fish and vegetables is the hypoglycemic diet. A diet like that, at the end of the study, 95% of the animals were still alive. If they gave them a normal glycemic diet, let's say that's meat, potatoes, gravy, and apple pie, normal glycemic for America, they found that 67% of them were alive at the end of the study. And if they gave them a hyperglycemic diet, which would be, let's say, Pop-Tarts, Pepsi, and potato chips, which is what most teenagers are living on, they found only 33% were alive at the end of the study. And if you listened to Dr. Perlmutter yesterday, you heard him talk about sugar also. The data is beyond argument that 140 pounds per year of refined sugar, of which 60 pounds is high fructose corn syrup, is killing Americans. It's causing obesity, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and a host of neurological disorders, including Parkinson's disease. So if you can get your patients to do nothing more than lower gut and blood glucose, you've made a huge victory. Actually, there was a beautiful study done by Sharaskin in the 1960s. Now, this is fascinating. You folks know that glucose and ascorbic acid are nearly identical as molecules and that they share receptor sites. When a cell is sucking in glucose, it uses the same turnstile to bring in ascorbic acid. And so what Sharaskin did is a study with humans in which he found if you raise blood glucose by 15%, so let's say a patient's normal is 100 milligrams per cent, that's their blood glucose, if you raise it to 115, you reduce intracellular ascorbate by 50%. You essentially induce intracellular scurvy merely by a slight elevation in blood glucose. So the glucose pipeline, it's food intake, it's food burn and exercise or basal metabolism, glycogen or storage, ideal blood glucose, 60 to 100 milligrams per cent. Some of it's stored as fat and the rest of it will start playing havoc with the prostaglandin system, and we'll talk about that. We're eating way too much sugar, as I said. You notice that the waistlines of Americans and our cars are following this commensurate rise in the size of our soft drinks in the movie theater. You notice this? When I started going to movie theaters in the 60s, you got an 8-ounce Coke. In the 70s, it was a 12-ounce. In the 80s, it was a 24-ounce. Now you get in the 90s, you get a 32-ounce with unlimited refills. And we got 60% of us markedly overweight, and cancer is increasing, and our SUVs keep getting bigger, and I don't know. So, sugar and cancer, many things we can do. Control blood glucose through diet, supplements, exercise, stress reduction, and medication if necessary. Things as simple as cinnamon lower blood glucose dramatically. Use of insulin, insulin potentiated therapy has some merit. Elevate blood glucose. This is a systemic cancer multi-step therapy used in Europe commonly. High-dose glucose potentiates anti-neoplastic therapies. Using TPN, always use a low glucose solution. In the 1960s and 70s, docs were taking in lots of cancer patients. They noticed a lot of them were starving, cachexia, lean tissue wasting. They looked like Auschwitz victims, and they said, maybe we should feed them. And the TPN they had at the time was basically stick a needle in the subclavian vein and give them sugar, 70% dextrose. And they found, you know, initially the patient sort of propped up and felt better, and then their cancer accelerated. So clearly if you feed the patient, you feed the cancer. Wrong. If you feed the patient dextrose or glucose, then you accelerate the cancer. So if what we're thinking about, think of this metaphor. In a garden, you have birds and bugs. And if there is a healthy balance, the birds eat the bugs and keep things under control. And you say, well, we're going to starve the bugs. No, I don't think you can do that. But if you feed the birds enough, they eat the bugs. And what I think about is the birds are your immune system. The bugs are the cancer. If you make the patient so strong, the birds will eat the bugs and keep the garden in a healthy symbiotic relationship. Regulate blood sugar to slow cancer growth. There's an abundance of data to support that notion. Let me give you some anecdotes. Patients that I've worked with. This lady came to us at age 69 with stage 4 breast cancer. Her bone scans lit up like a Christmas tree. And she had failed therapy at 2 other hospitals. She got with our program. It was not an easy affair. And what I find is the patient who does best is the one who has a co-patient. That means a helper. It could be brother, sister, father, mother, rabbi, pastor, I don't care. Somebody, they need a co-patient, because at certain points in therapy, especially this person, she flopped down, face down on the table and says, I can't do it anymore. And her daughter says, Mom, we're not quitting. Completely disease-free, and that was, she's 8 years out. This gentleman came to us with stage 4 lymphoma, had failed medical therapy. He came as a medical emergency on a stretcher, and he was literally dying of malnutrition. So we gave him our TPN, which is low glucose, high amino acids, and lipids are hung with it, and resuscitated him, then got him into some moderate chemo, and he was completely disease-free about 6 months later, and he was 8 years out into his disease-free. So a cancer victor. This lady had stage 3B breast cancer. She had a lumpectomy and did nothing else but nutrition. And that was 8 years ago, and she looks better than the doctor who said she was going to die. This gal here, Vicki Gerard, stage 4 breast cancer. Her bone cancer, bone scan lit up like a Christmas tree again. And she has been in remission, and she wrote a book called No Place Like Hope. She's an amazing lady. And what I found, the cancer patients who beat this, and many who don't, still will tell you, cancer is the best thing that ever happened to me. Any of you shaking your head with that? Because when you get up off the floor, what they're telling you is that it changes your priorities. What's important? Most of us spend all day, did you pick up the dry cleaning? Did you get the kids to the soccer match? You know, do we make enough money this weekend? Are we going to have a six-pack and a video? These are our priorities. And when cancer hits you, you start shuffling around your priorities. What's really important? Family and friends. And she's a very dynamic lady. Does fruit cause cancer? The answer is no. This was a study where they looked at a prospective study of 48,000 people, and they looked at prostate cancer incidence and found out the more fruit you ate, the lower your risk for prostate cancer. And you say, well, fruit's got sugar in it. Nature's stuff. Think about this. There are cofactors in fruit. For instance, in dark berries, there's ellagic acid, which is a substance that induces apoptosis in cancer cells. Apples have got about 200 different natural substances that all align to make them better than just having what you would think, well, it's just sugar, isn't it? No, it's a real food. Glucotoxicity, it causes many problems, and I'm going to have to fast forward here so we have at least a few minutes. There is this domino effect of raising blood glucose by 15%. And in America, we raise it by about 50%. We would like to see patients running 60 to 100 milligrams per cent as their blood glucose curve. Instead, it's much higher, and it creates all kinds of havoc in the body. This is oral glucose tolerance curves you're familiar with. The white is what we're looking for. If you put somebody on a Paleolithic diet, and they're healthy, and they're exercising, and they have adequate lean tissue, this is what you'll get. And this is what will lower the risk for many diseases. Exercise, you say, what does this have to do with cancer? One of the ways we lower blood glucose is by burning up the sugar. And one of the ways we do that is with a proper number of insulin receptors. In exercise, we stress muscle cells, and they actually generate more insulin receptors in the cell membrane. Why do we have this epidemic of diabetes in this country? One of the reasons is, as I said, the only exercise we get is coughing. And we've taken PE out of the school system, and I think that's a big mistake. So what do you mean, who says Americans don't exercise? You see the guys? I'm going to fast forward through that gut fermentation. We could spend an hour just talking about sugar and yeast and cancer. Now we're going to talk on this anti-proliferative factors. Nutrients as biological response modifiers. They change the way the body works to reverse cancer. And these are all well documented in the scientific literature. Let's look at studies saying what happens if you get decent nutrition to a cancer patient. In this study published in Anti-Cancer Research, they took lung cancer patients, knowing that if a patient has small cell lung cancer, it's a very poor prognostic malignancy, meaning about 1% will survive at 30 months. And so they said, what's going to happen if we give them some good nutrition? So the normal curve here is 6 months after diagnosis, you have 50% survival. 30 months after diagnosis, you have 1% survival. That's normal, what you would expect. SEER data, surveillance, epidemiology, and end result. In this group, they gave them good nutrition, and they found that 6 months after diagnosis, there was 94% survival. And 6 years after diagnosis, there was 44% survival, with half of them in remission. And what they commented, these were oncologists who said, no side effects were observed from nutrients. Can you tell me any drug that has such a clean track record? They said surviving patients started antioxidant treatment earlier than those who succumbed, meaning the earlier in the game you get into nutrition, the more likely you are to beat the odds. And antioxidant treatment should start as early as possible in combination with chemo and or radiation. Another study done by Hoffer and Pauling, and what they did is monitor 129 human cancer patients, and they looked at those who got just medicine, which is no nutrition support. So they got chemo, radiation, and surgery, and they lived an average of 5.7 months, and those who got nutrition were stratified into three different groups. The poor responders lived 10 months, which is still a 75% improvement over the group that just got medicine, and that ain't bad, but that was worst case scenario. And I find this in my own experience. About 80% of the people who come to you, if they have some vitality, some they're salvageable. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. At the risk of sounding gallows humor, but the doctor calls the patient, he says, Mrs. Jones, I have bad news and worse news. Well, what's that? Well, the bad news is we've done all of your tests and reviewed your charts and you've got 24 hours to live. Well, what's the worst news? We tried to call you yesterday. We get too many of these patients. You've got to have a certain amount of vitality. And what I find is nutrition is not unlike taking a patch of land and turning it into a vital garden. You find a patch of land that's in a ghetto, and you say, we're going to take the sticks and stones out, we're going to detoxify, we're going to till up the soil, we're going to nourish the land, we're going to plant the right seeds, water it, and it takes about 2 to 3 months before you can turn that soil around and get something productive. Same thing in patients. I find it takes. They got to have 2 or 3 months of lifespan expected or the outcome is pretty dim. In this group, they found 10 years life expectancy compared to 6 months if they use nutrition in conjunction with medical therapy. This study found that they could cut tumor recurrence in half, those who had bladder cancer. If they gave them nutrition at well above RDA levels, they could cut tumor recurrence in half. A study here found that they could get improved spontaneous cancer regression, which is a lovely euphemism saying we don't have a clue how you got better. But basically these patients did a diet rich in vegetables, some detox and vitamins. We didn't even touch on detoxification, folks. We didn't have time, but it's absolutely crucial. I mentioned the fact that Americans are loaded with toxins, heavy metals, volatile organic chemicals, and start with the mercury in their teeth. And just think about there's a need to detoxify those to allow the body to upregulate these non-specific host defense mechanisms. Much of the junk, the 90 billion pounds of toxins that we dump into our environment every year, are carcinogenic. They're mutagenic. You got to get them out of the system or the body can't heal. This study looked at, can nutrients extend lifespan in post-surgical lung cancer patients? The answer is yes. They took 36 post-operative lung cancer patients, evaluated them, the exclusionary criteria, the results. They found that the 19 patients who took vitamin supplements had roughly a 4 times longer survival. So lung cancer, surgery, give them vitamins or not. If they gave them vitamins, they live 4 times longer. Glycomics, I'd like to introduce this to you. Maybe not everybody's familiar with this. This is not in your handout. This has been done in the last 2 months. The subject of glycoscience, glycobiology, glycoproteins, glyconutritionals, these are all pseudonyms, aka it's the study of essential carbohydrates in human metabolism. Many of us in school studied what little we got on carbohydrates was, all right, glucose. We get way too much of it. Let's just move on to another more important subject. In fact, there are 8 essential saccharides for glycoprotein synthesis. Glucose, galactose, mannose, fucose, xylose, N-acetylglucosamine, N-acetylgalactosamine, N-acetylneuraminic acid. And what these form, folks, is the alphabet of life. How do cells communicate? Some with vitamins, some with cytokines. But there is this complex alphabet, this telegraph between cells that's made up of glycoproteins. And it essentially takes these sugars, mixes them in a variety of ways to form, the letters form words. And think about the difference between fiend or friend. There's a big difference in the meaning. If you're missing one of these sugars in that glycoprotein, it doesn't say the same thing anymore. Why is it that we find many cancer patients who have adequate levels of NK, natural killer cells, but they got cancer? Well, I thought natural killer cells were supposed to kill the cancer. What's happening here? Tumor recognition. Why isn't it recognizing it? Cell membrane dynamics. Maybe this whole business of glycomics. Do a Google on glycomics and you'll find that MIT has an entire department dedicated to this. The drug companies are enthusiastically pursuing glycomics with hundreds of millions of dollars in research, hoping to find patented medication. Where do we get it in the human diet? Plant food. This is where fruits, vegetables, grains, and legumes become biological response modifiers. They provide these glycomics, these essential sugars that mix with proteins that tell the body how to regulate. When there's a branch point in metabolism, it says, go this way. That's the proper way, not the other way. That's a negative way. So I think there's going to be a huge amount of information that will come out of this glycomics field. Synergism of chemopreventive nutrients, we'll fast forward. Selenium supplements, they found 200 micrograms a day of selenium cut cancer incidence, cancer mortality in half, something as simple as selenium. Bovine cartilage, a study by Pruden found that actually there was a 90% response rate in using 9 grams a day of bovine cartilage and 35% complete response. Bovine cartilage is a powerful biological response modifier. Then we start looking at fats. Cancer is generated by a whole host of problems in the body. Oncogene expression, cyclooxygenase, cell replication, immune dysfunctions. All of these are abnormalities that generate cancer, and all are controlled by eicosanoids, which are controlled by the fats in our diet. We eat a whole lot more vegetables, omega-6 fats, and a whole lot less butter, which, so we're getting this hydrogenated fat here, and we're getting a lot less of these monounsaturated fats, and actually some of the fats in butter have anti-cancer properties. Fat consumption in America, the ideal ratio would be 1-to-1 of omega-3 to omega-6. In the U.S., it's about 16 or 15-to-1, omega-6 to omega-3. And here's an interesting pathway that talks about eicosanoids are all derived from the diet. Dietary fats are saturated or unsaturated. They're N6, N3, or N9. The N3s go down into this PGE3 pathways. The N6s have a variety of ways that they can become good guys or bad guys based upon insulin. Now here's where we come back to the business of sugar. raise your blood glucose slightly, raise your insulin. If you raise your insulin, you take this pathway, branch point, and say, it's like a fork in the road for a train. If we go down branch A, the train is going to go to Denver and deliver the patients. If we go down branch B, there's going to be a head-on collision with another freight train. And what dictates it is sugar in the diet. So fish oils, the fats in the diet have a lot to do with recovering from cancer, and we'll talk about that if we have time. Fish oil supplements. A study that was taking, these were end-stage refractory cancer patients, 64 of them. They put them on a placebo or fish oil, and they found that the fish oil prolonged survival of all patients, resulted in a significant increase in survival, and it improved immune functions. Fish oil alone in dying cancer patients. Fish oil seems to induce apoptosis or programmed cell death in vitro. Gamma-linolenic acid improved outcome in breast cancer. This is a study with patients who were given tamoxifen with or without GLA, which is evening primrose oil or borage. And they found if they got the GLA with tamoxifen, there was a fourfold increase in complete responses. Anybody on tamoxifen should be taking GLA with it. They're synergistic. Flaxseed. Flax is good. Flax oil, I am a little uneasy about huge amounts of flax oil. Flax seed, full of lignans and this rich mixture from nature, very good food. In this study with animals, they gave mice, they fed them a variety of levels of flax, and they gave them melanoma, and then they measured the pulmonary or the lung cancer metastasis. And they found that the more flax they got, the fewer the metastasis and the smaller they were. Flax meal. So I think just take flax seeds, grind them up in a blender, and take a tablespoon or two a day. The gatekeeper, we don't have time to look at this, but essentially the cell membrane, the lipid bilayer, is made up of fats. And in America, it's amazing. You go through the grocery store and you look at this can of Crisco and it boasts on the label, no cholesterol, pure vegetable fat. And it's nothing but hydrogenated fat. The human body is not meant to tolerate this stuff. If you put that in the cell membrane, what do you think it's going to do? Cell membrane dynamics are all screwed up. It's not going to allow proper absorption, cell membrane receptors, and excretion of waste products. Finding the common ground in dietary recommendations. These are all MDs. Livingston, Gerson, Mormon, Hoffer all had their recommendations for a diet that would help cancer patients, and they all included fresh, natural foods. What's a good soundbite for a cancer patient? A whole food, plant-based, I don't think you have to be a vegan, but plant-based, meaning we're going to show you that, whole food, plant-based, mixed diet. Does that mean you have to exclude legumes? No. The no-grain diet, I think that's foolish. There are lignans in grains that are valuable, showing that they actually improve insulin response. And then dairy products, yogurt and cottage cheese are the preferred. So let's, another patient here was diagnosed with terminal kidney cancer, given 2 months to live in May of 2000, alive and well as of January 2003, a great gal, using nutrition as her primary modality. Herbal medicine, I cannot possibly do homage to this in the next 15 seconds, but I think our ancestors were practicing herbal medicine all day, every day in the kitchen. So while I think there's merit to cat's claw, podiarco, echinacea, there's some exotic herbs from China, wonderful, great. But don't forget that it begins in the kitchen as seasonings and as foods. And then that's a whole subject in itself. So how do you explain nutrition to your patients? I think this works very well, a very simple chart. Think of your plate as a pie chart. Cut it up into three equal sections. I would like you to cover the first one-third with lean and clean protein. Clean fish is the best, wild game, poultry, lean beef, eggs, Brewer's yeast, beans, dairy, spirulina, kelp. The vegans can still get by with this. The next one-third of the plate would be covered with cooked, wholesome plant food. Oatmeal, beans, bread, tortilla, pasta, yams, nuts, grains, legumes, and steamed vegetables, not microwaved. Microwave warms everything up, wonderful, but it kills most of the antioxidants. So in fresh vegetables, if you're going to microwave versus steam them, and you retain most of the antioxidants. And then the final one-third of the plate, raw fruits and vegetables with heavy emphasis on colorful veggies. The redder the tomato, the greener the spinach, the more orange are the carrots. And I've had many patients come to me who have been, they're exhausted, they're confused, they're frustrated, they're angry. They've been given four radically different diets. Most of them, they're incapable of following. But I find that this is very easy to follow and patients get better on it. Finishing it up here, reasons for an omnivorous diet, that's in your handout. Food pyramid for cancer patients, colorful vegetables and clean water at the base, legumes and lean protein, fruit, whole grains and nuts, essential fats, and then others. Nutrition supplements against cancer, there's many you can offer. A core would be a broad spectrum vitamin mineral, extra C, E, selenium, cod liver oil, carotenoids. If you push me into a corner and said, look, I got a lot of very poor patients. Some are indigent. They don't have a lot of extra pennies. Insurance doesn't pay for vitamins. What would you tell them to take? I'd tell them all to take at least one tablespoon a day of clean cod liver oil. All of them. Not going to do any of them any harm, and maybe more than one tablespoon. And it's going to regulate that eicosanoid metabolism. Okay, and there are the patients that I worked with, as I said, for the 10 years with cancer treatment centers, we would have a Celebrate Life reunion. Two-thirds of the patients who came to us, who were admitted, were refractory, meaning they had failed therapy somewhere else. And in spite of that, we had over 900 trees planted for people who were 5 years beyond their diagnosis, which is the definition of a cure. We're doing something differently, and as I said, I'm no longer full-time with the group, still have respect for what they're doing. My book, Beating Cancer with Nutrition, has got a lot more of this stuff in it, and we're back to the beginning. I've gone over time, but let me just offer you folks a couple of words of inspiration, I hope. And you can stay if you'd like or take off, but I have just two short stories. Cancer is the number two cause of death today. It will soon be the number one cause of death. And it's a very difficult, challenging disease to treat, but it teaches us a lot about how the body works. It teaches a lot about the tenacity of the human spirit. I'd like to offer you just two stories. One is a patient who didn't have cancer. I didn't work with. Galen Clark came to Yosemite Valley to die in the year 1850. This is a true story. He was dying from end-stage tuberculosis, coughing up chunks of his lungs. Doctor said, you've got 2 to 6 months to live. There is no cure for this ailment. This is about 1850. He was 42 years of age. And so he said, well, if I'm going to die, I'm going to get happy. Good idea. Talk to your patients. What would you do if you had a year to live? What would you do? Think about this. Write yourself a prescription for happiness. So he said, if I'm going to die, I'm going to Yosemite. That's the prettiest place I've ever been. What is your Yosemite? What is your patient's Yosemite? Second thing he did is he carved his own tombstone. He got comfortable with death. The question is not if we're going to die, but when. And a lot of people just sort of skate beyond that. I know a rich parish where two-thirds of the rich old men don't have a will. They don't want to think about death. So he got comfortable with death. He carved his own tombstone. He says, this is what I want people to remember me for. What do you want them to say at your funeral? Look, I think she's moving. Probably not going to happen, folks. He got happy. He carved his own tombstone. Then he started doing what he liked every day. Gee, what a thought. He got up every morning excited about the day. He was planting trees, creating trails in this valley that he loved so much. And number four, he started eating food that was available in Yosemite Valley in 1850, which was lean and clean wild game, trout, lots of clean water, a little bit of wild grains, some veggies and fruit. And he didn't die 2 months later at the age of 42. He died 54 years later at the age of 96. And what I'm sharing with you is the human body has extraordinary recuperative powers. And that nutrition is a part of that, not the whole equation. But if you and I can team together to resuscitate those non-specific host defense mechanisms, we can live a much longer and more fruitful life. And so I leave you with the blessing that as you slide down the banister of life, may the splinters always be pointed in the right direction. Thank you. I'll answer questions if you have any.
Wait, question.
I was curious.
curious about your percentage success rate with cancers. You mentioned 900 five-year survivals, but that's out of a population of...
Thousands. But realize two-thirds, the question is, what is your percentage survival? And we've tried diligently to come up with some realistic statistics that would be measurable. The problem is, how do you compare apples to apples when you're usually comparing apples to oranges? If you get in, let's say, 50 stage 4 breast cancer patients, and you say, well, they're all the same. No, they aren't, because this group had a whole different set of therapies than this group. This group has mets to the brain. This group has mets to the lungs. And how do you compare apples to apples? So the fact that two-thirds of the patients were refractory end stage, and the fact that there's 900 trees planted of those who should have died, it's doing something differently. I'd like it to be a more measurable, placebo-controlled four-year trial that would be a New England Journal publication. Ain't got. Yes, sir. Okay, good. He's asking why yogurt and cottage cheese and maybe not why other dairy. Is that the question? Well, dairy is a nutrient-dense food. It's also a food that unfortunately we have contaminated the cattle beyond recognition. And so if you take a cow that's grazed on a green pasture and it doesn't have its head locked in a vise and it's not fed antibiotics and a lot of veterinary drugs and it's not eating moldy hay, then the milk from that cow is fairly healthy. And most people have a decent tolerance for that food. Lactose intolerance is obviously an issue. Milk protein allergies is an issue. But there is good data. Joanna Budwig was the MD, PhD, who found that cottage cheese with flax oil made this magical combination that she felt had a synergistic effect against cancer. And it was a mixture of amino acids with the oils, the omega-3 oils, that she felt was very effective. I find that yogurt is extremely valuable. Yogurt, it's not just that it's milk, but it's in these fermented products. The whole business of fermented food is fascinating. You think about this. Grapes are a good food. Grape juice is okay. But wine has got irrefutable evidence that it extends lifespan. What's in the fermentation process? Milk is a good food. Yogurt's an extraordinary food. We find that in these microorganisms and in their byproducts, there's the ability to create order out of chaos in the gut. And so roughly 40 to 80% of the immune system surrounds the intestines, and yogurt seems to bring more order and immune stimulation out of that. There was a study done, for instance, they found that they looked at women with breast cancer and they did a diet history and found that if they ate yogurt once a week, they cut their risk for breast cancer by 40%. Yogurt's a good food. And to answer the second part, mechanistic on antioxidants and radiation. Back to the business of antioxidants are absorbed preferentially by aerobic tissue. Cancer is an anaerobic tissue. So what we're saying is healthy cells are drinking freely from the trough of antioxidants. And then cancer cells are not drinking so freely. What they're taking in is a little vitamin, actually maybe sometimes a lot of vitamin C. But when you go in with radiation, we find that you're killing a lot more cancer than healthy cells. And I have seen this. I remember a patient came to us with esophageal cancer. She had been diagnosed at her hometown. Doctor strapped her down to a table, put the radiation, the regional radiation machine over her chest, turned it on for 45 minutes and left the room. 45 minutes. And when he came back, he had killed a lot of cancer cells, but he also killed the mucous membrane in her esophageal lining. She couldn't swallow food. She came to us with malnutrition. My point is, we gave a lot of radiation to people, but when they're well-nourished before they get it, they do not get this hair loss, leukopenia, anemia, cytopenia, anorexia, all the commensurate side effects. And as a matter of fact, it seems to help the body with detoxification because radiation kills cells. Now, what are you going to do with them? You got to get them out of the body, accelerating detox pathways. And actually, it goes beyond antioxidants. There's good data showing that if you can give a vasodilator like niacin with radiation, because the most radiation-resistant tumors are these anaerobic masses. And so you ask the radiation therapist. I mean, I worked shoulder to shoulder with them, and they say, if you get a lump, you know, a 4-inch mass, the center of that thoracic is very anaerobic and it's very resistant to radiation. We give the patient like 1,000 milligrams of niacinamide, depends on if they're sensitive to flushing. Niacin will cause the flushing, but it also is a potent vasodilator. About 30 minutes prior to radiation, give whatever they will tolerate, 1,000 milligrams, and they find a dramatic increase in tumor kill with radiation. So this is where my thought of the marriage between nutrition and oncology has yet to blossom, but I hope it does. Ma'am. Yes, short course on detoxification. The body is detoxifying all day, every day. It makes its own toxins. For instance, hydrogen peroxide is a byproduct of aerobic metabolism, end product of energy metabolism. So we got to get rid of that stuff. We have many enzymes that are designed to detox our own innate toxic byproducts. The rascal is all of these exogenous toxins. The mercury in the mouth, the PCBs, the volatile organic chemicals. And then we've got toxins. What I find, many Americans have had chronic constipation. You pushed me into a corner and said, what are the hallmarks of a typical American cancer patient? I'd say chronic constipation, they don't like vegetables, they do like sugar, and they forgot how to laugh. And that's a good formula for getting cancer. Now, why do I mention the gut with toxins? Because many of the toxins in our body come from our gut. There is these 4 pounds, or roughly 20 trillion microbes in the gut. And if they're the right bacteria, and if you have 1 or 2 eliminations per day, you do not absorb a lot of toxins. If they're the wrong microorganisms, and you have 1 bowel movement every other day, then there's this extraordinary absorption of toxins from the gut. And we could go into auto-brewery, mycotoxins, and all that kind of stuff. But suffice it to say, a lot of toxins in the body, many of them are mutagenic, carcinogenic, and immune suppressive. How do we get rid of them? We eliminate through urine, feces, sweat, are those primary avenues. And you can help the urine with fluid, with vitamin C, with chelating agents. Things as simple as cilantro is a very valuable heavy metal chelating agent. With feces, you want to get that patient having 2 easy bowel movements a day, not diarrhea and not having to give colon cleansing every day. They should start doing it on their own. And then heavy metals, and this is where there's a marriage between dentistry and the oncologist. And why do we take the most toxic, non-radioactive substance on the planet Earth, mercury, and it arrives at the dentist's office in an EPA hazardous waste container, and they take it out of that and put it in your mouth, and if they drill it out, there are very specific formalities for drilling it and gathering it. They can't just flush it down the drain. They have to gather it and put it back into an EPA hazardous waste container and ship it to a special landfill site, but in the mouth, it's safe. Thanks for your attendance.
Thank you.